Can you turn the television on or open the front page of the newspaper and see people of your race widely represented? Can you choose blemish cover or bandages in flesh color and have them more or less match your skin? Can you go into a music shop and count on finding the music of your race represented? Into a supermarket and find the food that you grew up with? Or into a hairdresser's shop and find someone who can deal with your hair? If this is true for you, then you have what the associate director of the Wellesley College Center for Research on Women, Peggy McIntosh, calls white privilege. What is white privilege? When I think of the term privilege, I think of a word that was once reserved to describe the extreme end of the economically advantaged, the wealthy aristocratic class that inherited an unearned fiscal advantage. But with Peggy's use, the term is expanded to include those who are presumed to possess a surplus of social capital. They are socially advantaged, and that group is narrowed to the adjective that attends it. It is white privilege. So the term refers to the unearned social advantage possessed by white people in our society. Now, regardless of how one feels about the term white privilege and the ideology associated with it, one must acknowledge that everyone comes into this world with a set of unearned advantages. Among these, we could include being able-bodied, being intelligent, being attractive, being born into a two-parent home, being born into a free and liberal society. To the long and increasing list of benefits that one might enjoy, the Apostle Paul will add yet another advantage. One we might call Jewish privilege. What is Jewish privilege? What advantage did it give them? What did it not give them? And why should we care? We'll find out in our text today. If you will, meet me in Romans chapter 3. We will be continuing our portion of the story, picking up right where we left off last week. Romans chapter 3. And I'll begin in verse 1. What advantage then has the Jew? Or what is the benefit of circumcision? Great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. What then? If some were unfaithful, their unfaithfulness will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? May it never be. Rather, let God be found true, though every man a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. But if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I'm speaking in human terms. May it never be. For otherwise, how will God judge the world? But if through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged as a sinner? And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. Here Paul dives headlong into an argument with his antagonists in Rome through a rhetorical device that we call a diatribe. Now, normally when I think of the term diatribe, we might think of an individual who just goes off on a rant. He is just criticizing people harshly. In the epistles, a diatribe is an argument with a hypothetical objector. Okay, Paul is posing the questions that they might ask and arguing with his hypothetical questioner. And he begins asking about Jewish privilege. What is the advantage of the Jew? And how does it relate to circumcision? As you recall, circumcision was the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. It was the distinguishing mark that set the Jewish people apart as the nation who would serve as God's national representatives to the world. Through them, God would bless the families of the earth. Now, what benefit does the Jew have by being chosen as God's special representative to the nations? That's the question. Verse 2. Paul says, "Great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God." The Jews had a massive advantage. They had the scriptures. They had the revelation of God and His character. They had the revelation of God's plan to save the world. And if you were a Gentile in the Old Testament, you didn't know chicken. I mean, you were just groping about in the dark. You were without God and without hope in the world. God's special revelation came to the Jews. And they were supposed to take this special revelation to the nations, to the Gentiles. They were to be the salt of the earth. They were to be a light to the world, a kingdom of priests. But what if the salt loses its saltiness? Verse 3. What then? If some, and I'm going to render this, were unfaithful. Your text might say, did not believe. Same word. If some were unfaithful, their unfaithfulness will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? If God chose the Jews to be His special people through whom all the families of the earth would be blessed, and if He gave them the law, the revelation of His character, so that they would know how to represent Him as a nation, and if that law, that covenant, included blessings for faithfulness and curses for unfaithfulness, well, what if some were unfaithful? What if they broke the law and incurred the curses? I mean, will that prevent God from being faithful to His promise to Abraham? Will the unfaithfulness of Israel prevent God from blessing all the families of the earth? This is the biblical story. Let me explain how the Mosaic Covenant, the law, worked. The Abrahamic covenant came first. It came as a promise. The Abrahamic covenant was made as a promise to Abraham and to his seed. The Mosaic covenant came later. Okay, in the Mosaic covenant, the law functioned as a gatekeeper for the Abrahamic covenant. It's a gatekeeper. The law is like a bouncer, and the Abrahamic covenant is the party that the Jews want to get into. If they were faithful, the bouncer would say, "Right this way. Enjoy the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant in the land." But if they were unfaithful, the bouncer would say, "Y'all can't come in. Y'all can't enjoy the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant. In fact, y'all got to go." And he's going to toss them out on the street. That's the curses. So the tension here that Paul is addressing is, will the unfaithfulness of Abraham's seed, his descendants, will the unfaithfulness of Abraham's seed cause God to be unfaithful to His promise? Verse 4. May it never be. Rather, let God be found true, though every man a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. That God may be found true to what? True to the Abrahamic covenant. We're talking about circumcision, the advantage of the Jew. True to the Abrahamic covenant. May God keep his promise to Abraham even though the whole world is crooked. And the quotation here is actually from David. It's from Psalm 51. You may recall last week in chapter 2, Paul put himself in the place of Nathan the prophet. And he told his audience the same thing that Nathan told David when his hypocrisy was uncovered. You are the man. That's what Paul was saying to his audience. You're doing the same thing David did. Well, Paul is continuing to use David, and that psalm is David's plea for forgiveness in regards to that exact situation. David knows he's crooked, but the moral failure of God's man is not indicative of a failure in God. And we would do well to remember that. There's a Jars of Clay song that opens with the line, "The greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips, walk out the door, and deny him by their lifestyle. That is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable." From the Crusades to the manifold cases of child abuse in the Catholic Church, it is true that many interpret the sins of people associated with Christianity as a reflection on Christianity itself. And that is a terrible mistake. A pastor may become involved in a terrible moral failure, but that does not mean that God sanctions or even approves of such a failure. People will let you down. And if your faith is built upon the foundation of your pastor or some noble Christian in your life, get ready to be disappointed. But the unfaithfulness of people has absolutely nothing to say about the faithfulness of God. There is an early Christian creed that Paul gives to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 through 13, and it goes like this. Just listen. "It is a trustworthy statement, for if we died with him, we will also live with him. If we endure, we will also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. If we are unfaithful, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself." And that's what Paul is saying here in reference to Israel. If Israel is unfaithful, God remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. He cannot be anything other than who he is, and he is faithful. Verse 5. "But if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he?" If Israel's breaking the covenant demonstrates God's faithfulness in his condemnation of them, what should we say? We Jews. We shouldn't expect God to let Israel off the hook because they are his people, should we? That would make God a partial judge, an unrighteous judge. The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? He isn't going to let Israel get by with it, is he? Verse 6. May it never be. For otherwise, how will God judge the world? If God shows partiality to Israel, then He is not fit to judge the earth in righteousness. Because He's showing partiality to His Son. He's not calling it straight. He's not being a righteous and just judge. He cannot just let them get by with it. Verse 7. But if through my lie, watch your pronouns here, my who? My Paul. But if through my lie, the truth of God abounded to His glory, why am I also still being judged as a sinner? And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and as some claim we say, let us do evil, that good may come? This is what Paul is saying. If this is y'all's theology, if y'all think, verse 1, that the advantage of the Jew, that the benefit of circumcision, that although every man is a liar, verse 4, which highlights God's righteousness, verse 5, that the Jew, because of his relationship to Abraham, is going to get a free pass. Now, although every man's a liar, which highlights God's righteousness, the Jews will escape God's wrath because of Abraham. Now, if y'all think that Jewish liars won't be judged because of the advantage of circumcision, then why am I still being judged? By y'all in Rome as a sinner. If through my lie the truth of God abounded to His glory, what makes me any different than y'all? And if that's really how things work, why not say the very thing y'all are slandering me as saying, let's do evil that good may come? That's how you think it works. It makes no sense. The judgment upon them is just, and you know that it's just, because of their hypocrisy. See, Paul's a Jew. If they think they can get by with it, he gets by with it. He's circumcised. The judgment on them is just, and you know that it's just because of their hypocrisy in this. Now, what is Paul's lie according to the antagonists? What is Paul advocating that the antagonists are painting as the evil he wants to do that good may come? Verse 28. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law. See, Paul is saying that the righteousness that brings peace with God comes from faith and not from works of the law. The antagonists understand him as saying, verse 31, they understand Paul as nullifying the law through faith. That's Paul's lie. That's the evil. They're saying he's getting rid of the Old Testament. He's removing the requirement of law keeping. He's lowering the bar. Now, why would Paul do that? Look back at what he's saying in verse 7. If through my lie the truth of God abounded to His glory. And the assumption is that it has. Paul's removal of the requirement of law keeping has caused the truth of God to abound to His glory. What is the truth of God that Paul is talking about? Well, we already saw it. Look back at verse 3. What then? If some were unfaithful, their unfaithfulness will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? May it never be. Rather, let God be found true, though every man a liar. In what way Might Israel's unfaithfulness jeopardize God's faithfulness or nullify it? Well, we already mentioned, as long as Israel was unfaithful to the law, God appeared to be prevented from fulfilling His promises to Abraham to bless the families of the earth through his seed. So, allegedly, through Paul's lie that the law has been nullified through faith, God has been found true and faithful to Abraham by blessing the families of the earth through Messiah. See, they're saying Paul is lying to get the Gentiles to join in a false fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. The alleged evil that Paul is doing is removing the law so that good may come, so that Gentiles would submit to the God of Israel and His Son without submitting to the nation of Israel, without taking on circumcision and the law. So that's what they're saying. And Paul is saying, if y'all think Jews won't be judged because we're Abraham's children, then what's your problem? According to y'all's view, what I'm doing is no different than what you're doing. Hypocrites. That's why y'all are condemned. Verse 9. What then? Are we, Jews, better than they, Gentiles? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. There's none who does good, not even one. Their throat's an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths, and the path of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, this is one of those set of verses that is taking on a life of its own. You'll see it all over the place. I think of the Romans Road to Salvation tracts. What does the Bible say about the human condition? There are none righteous. Not one. I wonder, is that true? Or rather, is that what Paul is really saying here? Is Paul saying here in these verses that there are none who are righteous, not one? This set of verses is actually a host of quotations from the Old Testament, mostly from the Psalms. And it's important to remember that when a New Testament author quotes a text, he does it for the same reason that we quote people today. It's because the thing that we quote makes the point. The quote makes our point. And when we quote people, we don't just take a sentence and then employ it any way we like, apply it any way that fits our agenda, do we? No. We have to use it in context. We're basically importing the context of the passage that the person is speaking on. Because a statement taken out of context does not make the point. And your opponent would just say, I don't think that means what you think that means. So let's take a brief look at the passages Paul is quoting so that we can see the context that he's importing into Romans 3 to make his point. The first one is Psalm chapter 14. Psalm chapter 14, verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good. Not even one. Verse 4. Do all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the name of the Lord? That they are in great dread, for God is with the righteous generation. Hold on. I thought there were none righteous. Not one. It seems that the righteous are actually present in this very text. God is with the righteous generation. You would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge. Listen to another. Psalm chapter 5. Psalm chapter 5, verse 8. O Lord, lead me in your righteousness because of my foes. Make your way straight before me. There is nothing reliable in what they say. Their inward part is destruction itself. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Hold them guilty, O God. By their own devices let them fall. In the multitude of their transgressions, thrust them out, for they are rebellious against you. But let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy, and may you shelter them, that those who love your name may exalt in you. For it is you who blesses the righteous man, O Lord. You surround him with favor as with a shield. There he is again. The righteous man. One more. This is Psalm 140. Psalm chapter 140. I'm just going to start in the first three verses and then I'll skip to the end. Psalm chapter 140. Rescue me, O Lord, from evil men. Preserve me from violent men who devise evil things in their hearts. They continually stir up wars. They sharpen their tongues as a serpent. Poison of a viper is under their lips. Get verse 12. I know that the Lord will maintain the cause of the afflicted and justice for the poor. Surely the righteous will give thanks to your name. The upright will dwell in your presence. I think you get the point. If Paul wanted to simply say that there are none righteous, then why on earth would he proof text from chapters where the righteous are mentioned? Where there are righteous people? Understanding this, what is being said in our text in Romans? He's saying, y'all standing before God is not determined by your ethnic heritage. Remember verse 9. What then are we, Jews, better than they, the Gentiles? Not at all. We've already charged that both Jews and Greeks are under sin. Paul says, y'all are right. There are only two teams in this story, but it ain't team Jew versus team Gentile. That ain't it. It's team seed of the woman versus team serpent. And there are none righteous on team serpent. Not one. That's what he's saying. Notice verse 19. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. See, the law, the righteous character of God was given to Israel, those who are under the law. But the law couldn't make Israel righteous. The law could not impart righteousness, and it wasn't supposed to. It could only identify it. To put it another way, the works of the law were not deeds that a person could do to become righteous. They were descriptions of the kind of things that you would do if you were righteous. As one of my professors used to say, the law was made for one man, the seed of the woman. It identified the seed of the woman when he came on the scene. For the rest of Israel, it pointed out their sin. The law couldn't impart righteousness, but what it could do was condemn. It could condemn those who were not righteous. It could say, you missed it there. You missed it there. You missed it there. You missed the mark. Now, you might be thinking, wait a minute. If the law can't make you righteous, how were there righteous people in the Old Testament? Who on earth is David talking about? Verse 21. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe. For there is no distinction. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified as a gift by His grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation, as a satisfaction in His blood through faith. This was to demonstrate His righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, He passed over the sins previously committed. For the demonstration, I say, of His righteousness at the present time, so that He would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. If the law can't make you righteous, how were there righteous people in the Old Testament? Through the biblical story. The law and the prophets, the story, looked forward to a righteousness not gained through the law. From Genesis 3:15 forward, that is what the plot is about. That is what the Old Testament is about. They looked forward to the seed of the woman, the Lion of Judah, the Christ. And the righteousness of God was given as a gift to all who are looking forward to that one. Yes, all sinned. Yes, all fell short. No, none made the mark. But those who trusted in the seed of the woman joined team seed of the woman. Those who were looking forward to that one who would come to die on their behalf, to put an end to the serpent. Those who looked towards that one joined team seed of the woman, and the seed of the woman would die for them. Now we know that the seed of the woman came in history, in the man named Jesus. He was the righteousness of God in a man. He was the law of God in a man. In the Old Testament, God withheld judgment on Israel's sins through the sacrifice prescribed by the law, which was offered on the Day of Atonement. Once a year, the sacrifice was made on the Day of Atonement to cover Israel's sins, to satisfy the wrath of God. But that was just a placeholder. It was temporary. It was a stand-in. It couldn't remove sin. It was waiting for and pointing towards the righteousness of God who would come in history in the man Jesus of Nazareth, the God-man. And it was Jesus who propitiated. There's your 50-cent Bible word. It was Jesus who, it means satisfied. He satisfied the wrath of God through His blood, which removes sin. So now, in the present time, we are witnesses to the fact that God was more than just from withholding judgment, because we can see the outcome of His plan made clear. Through the giving of His Son, God is able to be just in dealing with sin while also being the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. That is what He's saying. He can justly condemn sin and pardon the sinner who accepts the sacrifice of Jesus in his place. 27. Where then is boasting? It is excluded. By what kind of law? Of works? No. But by a law of faith. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law. Or is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also. Since indeed God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith, is one. Do we then nullify the law through faith? May it never be. On the contrary, we establish the law. He says, I know y'all want to find some way to distinguish your own righteousness in this, but God has set things up in such a way that he gets all the credit. Because he did all the work. Jew, Gentile, we all come to the party through the same door, faith. And that doesn't nullify the law, nor does it remove the Old Testament. It's a doctrine that is based on the Old Testament. It establishes the law. The forward progression of the law finds its end in Christ. That's the movement of the plot. And now, through faith in him, God's character is written on our hearts. The character of the law is given to us so that we represent it. So what about us? To the best of my knowledge, nobody in this room is Jewish. So why should we care about Jewish privilege? Why should we care about the advantage that they had in receiving God's special revelation? We should care because of our privileged position in history. We're Gentiles. You know, we were born in another time in history, and just a little over 2,000 years ago, we'd be in big trouble. At that time, we were separate from Christ, excluded from the benefits of the nation of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, without hope and without God in the world. We were out there bedazzling tree stumps and stones and worshiping them. But now, God has brought the privilege of the Jews to us through the witness of 11 Jewish men, the apostolic witness. And now we share this incredible privilege, the Jewish privilege, by our access to God's revelation. And knowing that, we should also care about what that privilege did not supply for the Jews. Knowing the Bible, attending a weekly gathering in a community of faith, does not a Christian make. It will not save you. Christ saves you. And along with the Jews then, we have to put our faith in Christ. Christ alone for our salvation. Think of the lyrics. Till on that cross as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. For every sin on him was laid. Here in the death of Christ, I live. And the title of that hymn? In Christ Alone. That's it. God's wrath was satisfied in Christ. And we receive forgiveness of sins and resurrection life when we come in faith seeking righteousness through Christ alone. Not faith plus works. Faith in Christ alone.